chest and chest and long path and short path. Sometimes you hear both coming from the station. Let's say you're talking to, for example, somebody out there in Australia, New Zealand, and you're hearing them on short path, and then he's also, the signal for some reason is going out the opposite way, way around the world, coming to you from long path. You can hear an echo with a delay, an actual audible echo. Over.
Yeah, Chet. Yeah, I've heard reports of that. That must be fascinating. In the old days, and we mentioned it a few times with phone freaking and people kind of commandeering the telephone system, they would often channel their connections around the world a few times to demonstrate the latency delays of long transmission lines. So yeah, you can sometimes get an echo in, first you hear your short path reception, and then because electromagnetic waves take time to propagate, you then hear the second one. So depending upon the differences in time, it could be a reverb or it could be a really echo type of phenomena. So that's a good thing to point out, Chet.
Coming.
Yes, Wesley.
Hey, we're thinking about Diana's your reflection. So I was thinking about saying a few words about. So it's interesting thing that troposphere index of refraction is independent of frequency. For ionosphere, however, the refractive index of medium is a function of transmitted frequency. So if you look at the chart, ionosphere is about 48 kilometers to 965 kilometers above the sea level. And then we have a stratosphere, mesosphere, tetrasphere, all that it. Now, the higher we go, the less dense is the air. So, but still, ionosphere is a part of the atmosphere. And then we have, we're talking about the frequency about below 1,000 megahertz. Then we have five parameters defining the rate, which is amplitude, direction, propagation phase, and frequency of polarization. And polarization, and those are actually affected by atmospheric irregularities or various size of moving source. Because I assume that ionosphere is not static. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you.
AC2GS. So, well, you're right, Wesley. We mentioned it's kind of river-like. It's chaotic. It fluctuates. It ebbs. It flows. And the ionosphere is completely different than the tropospheric propagation. Tropospheric propagation is the layer of the atmosphere close to the ground in which thermal inversions will cause the area to be more refractive. Usually that takes place on very high, ultra-high VHF, UHF. That's where the reported cases of guys on 2 meters in California are talking to Hawaii using tropospheric propagation. Whereas for most of us, most of the time we're utilizing a much higher level of the atmosphere where there is ionization. The troposphere is not ionized. Troposphere is refractive for a different reason because of a thermal inversion, because of weather patterns and such.
So actually, we talk about the electric constant of refractive or refractive index in the ionospheric regions. Interesting.
Well, it depends upon which type of ionosphere, the D, the E, the F1, the F2. Refractive material, you know, glass is a refractive material. They have optical density. And so in the same way, the ionosphere is a refractive medium. Depending upon how much it's energized, it changes its optical density. It changes its impedance. And so that affects the the way that it refracts electromagnetic waves of a given frequency, so, you know, depending upon its energy level. So it's a really complicated field to discuss. You know, I'd best to keep the concepts of refraction relatively simple, again, without very nice illustrations.
Yes, I understand that. I believe we should take into consideration speed of light, velocity of propagation in the medium of index, and relative dielectric constant of the medium, and relative permeability of the medium. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, almost all of those things are interrelated with each other. There are different ways of describing optical density or impedance. It sort of goes back to the good old days. Dick K2RIW would discuss Q factor. And there's about 15 different ways that you could accurately and very differently describe Q factor. And so is the same with the optical density of a medium for electromagnetic waves. It has to do with the permittivity. It has to do with the optical density. It has to do with all those things. They're all expressed in terms of the same quantities. So they're just different ways of describing pretty much the same characteristic of a medium, of a impedance source.
You're not talking about something that is steady function. It's a variable, varying function, and actually, I'm talking about a very varying function of the path.
Yeah, again, my analogy of choice is a river. It's not a constant. It's not like the insulating foam of a coaxial cable. That's a solid medium for the most part, and it doesn't change. This is an impedance source or an optical density that is ebbing and flowing and changing direction. And just to make life even more complicated, in addition to its changing refraction and amplitude, it also rotates its polarization angle through Faraday rotation. Just to make things a little bit more complex.
I understand that. I was rather thinking about function of time, of day, and the magnitude of the recent sunspot activity that affect the local ionospheric storms and local latitude.
At the very core, this is incredibly sophisticated physics going on. So we're trying to keep it relatively simple. I don't want to make it devolve into a fairy tale where it's not really anything like reality. But, you know, there's a certain level of complication that people just, you know, shut their ears and move on to other things. So it's a fascinating subject, the ionosphere, all the layers of the ionosphere, how they respond differently to different stimuli, how different frequency signals, some are refracted by one layer and transmitted through another layer. So it's, you know, it's at the very core of any kind of reasonable discussion of what propagation is all about.
Question that I have, to your knowledge, anybody still doing moon hunting?
Moon hunting? Did you say moon hunting?
Yeah, moon hunting is there is the antenna at the moon and trying to reflect, you know, electromagnetic waves so it passed somewhere and somebody else. Because it's kind of 2000 that I have has this function moving on.
Yeah, most of the time people call that moon bouncing. Barry was a big moon bouncer, and Dick, may he rest in peace, had that QSL card of the array of Yagis. I think it was UHF that he used, I think, for moon bouncing. He also designed a linear amplifier. Because back in the old days, you need large arrays of highly focused Yagis, and you need a linear amplifier to put out a legal maximum. Nowadays, thanks to Joe Taylor, there are still moon bouncers out there, but the old-time moon bouncers aren't really thrilled with them. because since they used Joe Taylor's low signal algorithms, computer algorithms, they can get success using far less antennas in their arrays and far less power in their transmitters. So moon bouncing is still going on. It's a little bit more computer driven using Joe Taylor's algorithms, but it's still there.
Right. Moon bouncing is the right terminology, although in Europe, where I was born, people were calling it moon hunting because first you had to hunt the moon in order to bounce from it. Back to you.
Well, I don't want to be glib, but I would think that would be the easiest part. You just kind of look up.
Okay, thank you very much. Wait.
Okay. Rich, any more on this particular subject? I don't want you to jump to the next subject because you never gave me an opportunity to talk about the artificial intelligence comment that you made.
No, done with this one, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay. I want to caution people. Artificial intelligence is interesting, but in many ways problematic. I think I've mentioned in the past, Michael Cohen, the lawyer that had to go to jail for a year or two, relied on ChatGPT to cite legal cases that didn't exist. ChatGPT can be very charming. It can be very conversational. It is programmed to be conversational. It is not programmed to be accurate. So I would triple check anything that it gave me as far as facts are related. And lawyers have their own syntax and grammar, and if you flush it through an artificial intelligence, you might miss on some of the legal nuances that without a law degree we're all blissfully unaware of. So, you know, I understand where it can be very exciting that you can have a chat with something that isn't alive. It's a novelty, and it can be exciting. But if you talk to it long enough, you kind of see the empty spaces in its artificial brain. And like I mentioned way back at the beginning of this ChatGPT discussion, you can convince ChatGPT that 1 plus 1 equals 72. And it will apologize for making the error that it's equal to 2. So it's not really programmed to be infallible. Matter of fact, the front page says in little print that, you know, it is not infallible. And it certainly isn't. Especially artificial intelligence image production has a terrible problem with people's fingers. One of the giveaways to at least up until recently, images generated by computers is, if you count the people's fingers, very often they have six fingers or four fingers. These videos that they've been generating lately will show people's right leg and left leg switching position. So it has its own little weird foibles.
Now, I compared the ChatGPT version of the course or the paragraph to the original, and it absolutely kept the essence, that's a good way to put it, the essence of what all that legalese, the therefores and whereases, you know, got in the way of the essence of the clause. I compared them very carefully, and ChatGPT did a great, great job.
Okay, I don't know if we have any lawyers out there, but being clear and understandable is probably not the primary goal for legal documents. Again, they have their own interesting use of the English language that people who haven't gone to law school probably is blissfully unaware of. So I appreciate that it was more understandable and readable to you. It would be interesting to me to have, say, a guy with a law degree read it over and give a kind of his opinion of whether clarity is a good thing for legal documents. Again, I find in the past that legal documents are kind of designed to be somewhat obtuse to people outside of the field. you know, again, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't even play one on the radio.
WS2N.
As I said before, well, my father was a tax attorney, and he was known in his company for the brevity of his contract writing. He was known for that. I remember it as a kid. And I will send you, Roy, I'll send you the original paragraph and what ChatGPT did to it. And maybe next week we could discuss whether by simplifying it, it didn't make everything clearer. I know lawyers make a lot of money by complicating things or using legalese, but I think between a layman and like a guy who wants to buy a condo, I think filling this stuff down to its essence is doing a big favor to the layman. I'll let you decide. How's that?
Well, by the way, Paul recognized, we'll get to you. Listen, Paul, again, I have no particular expertise in the field of law. I have relatives who are lawyers, but I never took a law course. So busy taking physics and chemistry and mathematics and anthropology and English and stuff like that. So, you know, maybe I'll have an opportunity to have someone with a law degree take a look through it. Again, it's a kind of optimistic viewpoint towards the world that a legal document should be easily understood by all. It doesn't seem to function that much in the real world. So my assumption tends to be that that is not a mistake or an error that is done on purpose for legal reasons. So again, send it to me. I'll read it through. If I'm able to get a lawyer to look at it as well and give his 2 cents worth, that would be even better. Because again, what do I know from legal documents? But I'll be more than happy to read it. By the way, Paul, you want to say something?
That's about it for me. So thanks, Roy. Thanks, everybody. WQBZ, back to Nick.
Okay, I thought you said that you had another question after the question about the ionosphere. You did?
I do, but it's non-ham radio, so if somebody else, I think, waiting in line that has a ham radio question, if not, yeah, I'll ask it for you. It's of much lighter fare than what we've been discussing.
Okay, so we'll get back to you. We'll go to John for his question. When we finish, John, we'll go back to you. But, Paul, you wanted to say something.
Yes, in regard to the AI. AI came up during the ComputerNet, and Ken was talking about it, and I told him about the pictures that you generated with AI, and they were on your website. So I copied a couple of them. But I just need you okay, because I'll send them over to Ken, and he's fascinated with that idea, just how they came out. I described that you put in 20 meter Yagi and you came up with a contraption that's unbelievable. So he's looking to see that. So you're okay. I'm going to send it over to him back to you.
AC2GS. Yeah, sure, you're perfectly free. I posted it on the internet. It's free for the world. Thankfully, the company that has these graphic AI systems lets you do it without paying them. So, yeah, you're more than free to send them copies or send them links to the page where they're published.
Very good. With all this lawyer talk, I figured, hey, maybe you got these things copyrighted. Anyway, they're incredible. Incredible pictures. I think there were like 3 or 4 of them. Very good. Thanks, Roy. Back to you.
Thank you, Bill Cummings.
Yes, please, Jeff.
Just wondered if you wanted one more quick anecdote about the answers, the scientific anyway, that it gives.
Yeah, sure.
All right. We, as you know, we're biochemists. and myself and a six-year student, we're just going over some of the data that's going into his thesis, and the two of us were stumbling over some things about pKa and the binding constants in a particular active site for a particular enzyme. And so as a joke, we formulated a question for ChatGPT about it. And in our analysis, the answer that ChatGPT gave was correct, but it was because it made two very important mistakes. Each one of them canceled each other out. So, yes, the answer was right. The logic behind it was 180 degrees off twice.
Okay, so it was a fortuitous result. The bottom line is, at this point, do not rely on artificial intelligence for correct answers. They just know how to string words together and not have it make complete nonsense. So sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. Now, you know, it's kind of like instead of using a sophisticated, a generative artificial intelligence program, you're flipping a damn coin. If you feel comfortable with flipping a coin to get your answers, then have fun. But otherwise, it's a very interesting glimpse into a very problematic future when they actually get this stuff right. Then, you know, I don't know who's going to be left employed under those circumstances, but that probably is going to take a little time. Although you never know about the rate of acceleration of technology. He can speed up and slow down at any moment. So thank you for that, Jeff. Okay, we're on to our next person, John. What's your question for tonight, John?
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Two questions. Just getting back to the ionosphere really quickly, very quickly, and is it a correct assumption to assume the ionosphere, from what I read, I know it's fluid, but it seems we get the bounce when it's positively charged. At least I believe that's what I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong. So is it that the radio wave we consider also positively charged and it's a type of light charges repel?
Okay. Well, the simple answer is no. Electromagnetic waves do not have an inherent charge, so they're not attracted or repelled by a charge. And the ionosphere is not necessarily just positive. It's what happens is the solar radiation knocks the electron, which is negatively charged, off of the atom. So you have atoms and molecules, O2 and N2 and other such things, that is positively charged, and then you have free electrons in that environment. Under those circumstances, though, electromagnetic waves do interact with charged areas in acting like a glass, like a transparent object that affects the propagation of electromagnetic waves going through that ionized gas. And that apparent change in velocity according to angle of incidence is pretty much what refraction is all about. So it's not necessarily that the ionosphere is positively charged. It's positively charged in some places, it's negatively charged in others. The important thing is not the charge polarity, the important thing is the charge existing.
Okay, in all the diagrams, and I know they try to make it as easy and understand and, maybe not even accurate, but they show it going up and coming back down, almost like a bounce. But if I'm understanding you correct, it's not that. It's actually being refracted. So it may go in many different directions, and when you're lucky, it gets completely round and bounced back down to the Earth. Is that accurate?
To a degree. Well, once again, pretty much anything, any electromagnetic wave that hits some kind of transparent surface partially reflects, refracts, scatters, absorbs, and transmits. So there is a small amount of pure reflection taking place on the interface between non-ionized atmosphere and the ionosphere. There's another level of reflection that takes place by the refraction, the bending of the electromagnetic waves back onto themselves and back down to the ground. And there's others, some of the electromagnetic waves get scattered around, and others get absorbed, and others get transmitted right through it into outer space. So, it's complicated, but usually if you have a directional electromagnetic wave propagating at the ionosphere, it's going to refract off of the ionosphere at the incident angle that's penetrating the ionosphere. So a significant portion of it is reflected down. This always spreads no matter what you do. So it's going to refract back and scatter over a larger area when it comes down. It's not going to be kind of a pinpoint strike on the ground necessarily. Although I have had times, and I've mentioned it here, where for whatever reason the propagation conditions were perfect between Brooklyn and a medium-sized city in Nebraska, and I spoke with four or five guys from the same city who didn't know each other, one after the other, simply because the freakish kind of ducting that took place under those circumstances. But a lot of times it's much broader than that.
Okay, very good. Understood. Thank you. The second question is, when we transmit, it produces a small voltage in the receiver via the antenna. This is a theoretical question. If we surrounded a transmitter with millions and millions of antennas that were at the same wavelength, so they're all receiving this signal, would it effectively just diminish the signal? Would it take all the energy out of it and just block it from going any further?
The energy cannot be created or destroyed, so you have to have conservation of energy. So if you have a whole bunch of receiving antennas near your transmitting antenna, it's soaking up some of the energy and taking it, I guess, to the ground because it's got to go somewhere. So, yeah, you would have less electromagnetic field in that environment due to a lot of antennas. And also, I always like to occasionally make things a little complicated. Near-field and far-field effects are very different from each other. So if you put another antenna within the near-field, you will have a greater drain on your transmitter than if you didn't have that antenna in the near-field. But if you take the same antenna and you put it outside the near field into the far field, having it be there or not be there will not change the power draw that the transmitter is undergoing. So that's another little layer of complication, that near field antennas can actually cause more power to be drained out of your transmitter.
Okay, and just to wrap it up, is that the reasoning behind sometimes what we'll see dual verticals and dual yagis? Is that trying to absorb literally twice the amount of power from the transmitting the signal?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, when it came to moon bounce, the problem originally before Joe Taylor's low signal algorithms was that there's a lot of attenuation. You know, we use the inverse square law as always. So to get all the way to the moon and then to expect it to reflect a lot, the moon is not a highly reflective object. It looks bright to us, but if you were standing on it and looked down, it's rather a dark gray. So the amount of signal loss is profound, and so that's why the more yagis you focus in on a particular area, the more signal. Each of the yagis will receive a certain amount of the signal, and you can strap them all together and increase the final signal by, you know, putting a 4x5 array of yagis. So you get 20 times the signal. Also, with moon-bound skies, they also would go full legal as far as the output. So, yeah, if you put two relatively similar antennas near each other, you will effectively have a 3 decibel gain in your signal. If you put 4, you'll have a 6 decibel gain. And it goes on and on like it's all additive. And, yeah, it's microvolts, but it's also going through a given impedance. So that's watts. That's joules. And that's energy. And so the electromagnetic energy in electromagnetic waves are channeled down to a receiver, amplified with very little noise, hopefully, and it gives you a signal that you can perceive.
All right. Really beautiful explanation. Thank you, Roy. And I'll bring it back to Ned.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John, as always. Rich, you want to do your next question now?
Yes. I know you're a big fan of science fiction. And Dune 2 has just come out, and I've been reading really good reviews about it. Have you seen it? Do you know anything about it?
Well, I know a bunch about it. I unfortunately haven't gotten around to seeing it, but it's one of those things I'm going to do. I'm one of those guys who read Dune at least once every 10 years. I loved Frank Herbert's novels. I've read all that he's written, and to a degree, unfortunately, I've read the kind of second-rate stuff that his son has written in that world to make a whole bunch of money. But I love the concept of Dune. The original movie back in the 80s was kind of weird and goofy. The made-for-TV was rather chintzy and cheap. But thankfully, Denis Deneuve, whatever his name is, is an artist, and more important, he was given enough bucks to make a beautiful film. So the first one, and I enjoyed it. There were some people who were not originally a Dune fan. They found that it was a little slow going. It was kind of setting things up for the second film, which is never a good experience for most people because they got to wait a year or two or three or four for the second film. But I've heard a lot of great reviews, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I the book is great. Anyone has any kind of free time, pick up a used copy and read it. It's loads of fun.
I think it's, did I read that, I don't know if it's separated into 3 or 4 separate books, but one of them I read is 526 pages. Was that just like part one or part two?
Well, the original novel is Dune. Then there's a bunch, and because it was rather a large book, I don't forget exactly how many pages, but they split it in half for the movies, at least for these movies. They rushed through it back in the 80s. They broke it into a mini series for Sci-Fi Channel. But I think there's 5 different books. The next one is Dune Messiah. So the story that everyone is kind of trading back and forth is that this director started off with the idea that he wanted to do Dune in 2 parts. So it was going to be a 2-film thing. And if he had the strength and the production company was behind him, he would make it a trilogy by doing Dune Messiah after that, because I don't want to ruin it for everyone, but all the characters are kind of set up at the end of the movie. They haven't really done a lot of things that they're going to do in future books, and the kind of a hero character has a big part to play in the next book. So it'll be kind of easy to go to slide from Dune Part 1 and Part 2 to Dune Messiah. If they want to do the other books after that, it focuses much more on Paul's children rather than Paul.
Okay, well, I'm excited to see Dune 2. Apparently the two main characters have a great old-time, old-studio compatibility. I read one review that said the two main characters just worked beautifully together. I'm anxious to see it. Even though I didn't really like Doom 1 so much, but this one's supposed to be a lot better.
Well, my understanding is there's a lot of great performances from a lot of the actors playing characters. There's a lot of historic character acts. It's not only the hero and the enemy. There's the enemy's uncle. There's the hero's mother. There's a lot of politics that goes on. Unfortunately, even a two-part movie was unable to condense the entirety of the Dune novel. So my understanding is that there's a good 25% that are completely removed from both of the films. There are a bunch of characters that had a bigger part to play that don't really show up on Dune 2 because there's just not enough room for them. So you have to make 2 to 5-parter or something, which I'm sure the company financing it would just scream in horror over. But yeah, I think you'll enjoy it. Again, I haven't actually seen it, but I've heard a lot of people report in on it, and I've read the book multiple times, so I'm a big fan of it. It's a very difficult film to actually produce because it's not a soap opera, it's not a space opera, it's not Star Wars. It's a lot more intellectual. It's about political intrigue. It's wheels within wheels. It's plots within plots. And, you know, if you could tolerate that, I found it an exciting adventure. If anything, when he writes in the book, he glosses over the battles. The battles kind of fill up about 2 pages, and then he's back to politics. That's not going to be the case with the film. The battles, I'm told, are going to look real nice. So anyone out there, consider getting it and going there and seeing it. And certainly when it's available on cable, give it a watch. I think it's making more money than a lot of the recent movies. I think this weekend in the United States it made something like $83 million. So I don't expect it to kind of die in a week or two. I think it has a lifespan more than that. So I'm really looking forward to it. Probably, to give it justice, I should take it in during that high-resolution, enormous picture theater thing. I don't think there's too many of them out there, but probably one in Manhattan. I have to look into that.
What's the name of that movie again, Roy? WP2BS.
Yeah, it is Dune, D-U-N-E, Part 2.
Oh, okay, the old Frank Herbert story. Yeah, very good. If you want, I did look up a long path and short path for one of my recent contacts, if you want to get back to that. Otherwise, we can do that later or next week.
Yeah, let me have a chance to see if I could put some images up on my link page. You know, with things like that, I think, it doesn't hurt to have some pretty pictures.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm going to be off for a couple of minutes here. If you want, find something very interesting. I'll give you the call sign. I just looked up somebody at work recently. X-ray Victor 9 Golf. Look up the path on that. It's kind of interesting. I'll be listening. I'll probably be back in about 20 minutes. That'll be the BTBS show.
Okay, very good, Frank. So, Rich, I appreciate the intro to kind of do my advertisement for Dune 2. Partially I would like it to be successful so that the greedy guys in Hollywood will bankroll Dune Messiah. And who knows, maybe we'll get a few more. I don't necessarily want to see movies based on the books of his son and his son's friend, but I would like to get all of the Dune series. The problem, unfortunately, was that Frank Herbert never really ended his story. And he, the way it unfortunately ended was very weird. The last book that he wrote was about people escaping the galaxy into the unknown, and in one of the strange ships was a bunch of traveling Jews after 10,000 years. We're still there, according to Frank Herbert, so yay that.
Mazel tov.
Yes, indeed. You know, I was amazed and kind of, at the time I thought it was a wee bit silly. Because any other religion kind of merged and kind of stuck to each other. There were the Zen, Sumi, you know, half Asian, half Muslim, and there was the Orange Book of Christianity, which didn't sound like Protestantism or Roman Catholicism. So it was kind of a mishmash. It was like someone had put a bunch of religious texts from different places in a blender. But through it all, at the end of all those books, there were the wandering Jews.
That's great. Congratulations, Roy. AC2PL.
Okay. Anyway, Rich, so I guess that's the total content of that question?
It is, Roy. For some reason, I pushing the button on Echolink didn't help. I wonder if we could do a little experiment. Your signal is, I would say, 25% louder than everybody else's, and it's very harsh. I don't know if anybody else hears that, and it may just be my cell phone. But could you turn the gain down about 25%, and we'll see if that makes your signal much less, well, to be frank, annoying. It's a little harsh. It's like breaking up on the top end. I wonder if just try that.
Yes, I can try that. How's this?
Transmit for a little bit longer. I think it was too short. Try it again. Go ahead.
Okay, I will try to make up a bunch of stuff to talk about. Hopefully not fall into a soliloquy. By the way, pretty much every Sunday night you inevitably hear some line from Shakespeare. I assume some of you recognize it and others just wonder what the heck I'm talking about. Anyway, that should be enough for you to figure out if I'm less annoying. Yes, John?
Seemed like a good time to come in and say what you're sounding that way. My new All-Star note here, by the way, live on a repeater here in Waco, covering part of White Rock, Alamos. And we're up and running again here with a new system. Thanks. Good friend, and picking some net. And you are also...
Okay, well, I lowered it a bit. Am I still overdriving?
Yes, you are. I didn't hear. There's absolutely no change.
Okay, that's because I adjusted the headphones instead of the microphone. How's this?
Better, but I would say now you're about 10% overdriving.
Okay, how about this?
Comment?
I hear you.
Say again. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
The distortion is before your gain. Before your gain is coming right from the microphone.
Okay, can't do a heck of a lot, but that's the mixer. As it is, the mixer is doing weird things. It's not really letting me get the headphone feed. So I've been needing to tell the output of the radio and using the microphone. So it's probably doing some wacky little thing with the microphone as well, unfortunately.
Well, it's better that it's lower. The gain is lower, but it still has that distortion on it. Can you roll the treble? Do you have an equalizer that you can play with?
Not really that I can play with, because it's already kind of iffy, and if I screw it around any worse, then it's going to be worse. So, you know, when I'm off I can twiddle around with mixer settings and such. But while I'm on, I'd rather not kind of blow up my microphone connection right now.
Okay, it's now it's the exact same signal, except because it's lower, it's a little more tolerable, but the distortion hasn't changed at all. So maybe that's something you could look into for next week. That's all, Roy. Thanks very much for everybody's answers for me and yours also. Back to you, Roy.
WS2N. AC2PM.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, Roy, I know it sounds better for Rich, but you went a little too low, in my opinion, because if I listen to you now, you're low, and Rich is coming in loud, because, you know, I have to adjust the volume. So I would go, you know, split the difference and come back further up if you can. And by the way, were you talking about the Tempest before?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, when you sign. Very good. I'm terrible with Shakespeare, but I always have to get involved a little bit because a lot of the moons are named after people in his plays. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of chose that because one of the interesting things that me and Dick agreed about a lot of things, but Forbidden Planet. I love Forbidden Planet. I watched it, I think, on Channel 9. They ran the same damn movie all weekend long. And when they did that with Forbidden Planet, I must have watched it at least half of the times that they played it. I have Robbie sitting in the shack with me. And that is a science fiction adaptation of Shakespeare's Tempest. And we talked about it one technical net for a good, I don't know, 45 minutes or so. Altair and the solar system and the planets and the whole concept of the movie. So I kind of, and I always like to throw in at least one line from Shakespeare every Sunday night. So it's the easiest thing for me to do.
Okay, understood. By the way, it was just on Turner Classic Movie. I just recorded it the other day. So, although I've seen it a million times, I'll probably see it a million more. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, it was Leslie Nielsen doing an actual dramatic turn. That was before he became so popular doing farce. Jeff, you wanted to say something?
Unfortunately, I was going to take it another direction, but if you guys want to carry on, that's absolutely fine with me.
No, I think we kind of came and went with that. If you got something else.
Yeah, Roger, very good. Your audio at all levels was completely readable. I disagree with the other station saying it wasn't, or even that it was harsh. It was not annoying. It was completely readable. It's probably just the iPhone that he's using. The question is, we're talking about reflection, refraction, transmission. I wanted to ask for just a quick and dirty review of Doppler shift. So I've done the you know, the frequency test where they transmit on a particular frequency and you're supposed to receive and figure out down to the last millihertz and microhertz on what the frequency was. And, of course, you can always see a little Doppler shift going back and forth. And I was wondering if you wanted to just quickly touch on the source of that QSL.
Sure. AC2GS, by the way. Doppler shift, there's relativistic Doppler shift and then just standard Doppler shift. And if you've ever kind of stood as an ambulance drove past you, you've experienced the Doppler shift. Other people that tend to like to hang out by train stations when they whistle will notice what's going on. And when a sound source is approaching you, at a given velocity, each wave tends to reach you a little bit earlier than it should because it's traveling towards you. So you perceive that as an increase in frequency. So the ambulance siren goes up in frequency as it approaches you, stabilizes, and then as it leaves you, going on to the rest of its little travails, it's now racing away from you. So each next pulse of the sound wave is actually reaching you a little bit later and later and later and later, and so you perceive it as the frequency goes up when the ambulance gets to you and then goes back down as it disappears into the distance. So that's Doppler shift. Physicists use Doppler shift all the time. They use it to discern velocity of objects from afar. It's a cute trick to do that. You don't need a tape measure. So that's kind of the shortest version of Doppler shifting. If anyone has any questions or comments, please feel free.
Yeah, I think you could say a few words about multipath Doppler shift in man-made electromagnetic waves.
Yeah, I was thinking more along the lines of RF from HF transmission, QSL.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it depends upon your electromagnetic waves. If they have a moving source or if they have a moving reflector that supplies the signal to you, it can shift your perceived frequency reception in the same way that audio frequencies are shifted by velocity. Is that what you were kind of getting to? As far as Wesley, a lot of times, unfortunately, you have reflection of electromagnetic waves, and so they have multipath. In the good old days when we were all young, that's why we had 2 and 3, 4 television images superimposed, because the signals were not going straight from the antenna on the Empire State Building, but they were bouncing off buildings and taking different distances with different delays and producing echoes and double up type of things.
I'm talking about from two fixed antennas receiving and transmitting. They run these tests, these frequency measurement tests, FMTs. They give you an approximate range where you're supposed to look, and they transmit for a minute, and you're supposed to receive, and you're supposed to figure out, based on the calibration of your equipment, what the frequency is. And there's always a little bit of drift back and forth. I don't know if it's properly called Doppler or, if there's a shift in the ionosphere that changes the path, if that somehow changes the frequency. But it's an intriguing effect, and it's... I've always wondered what the physical basis for it was.
Okay, I wonder... Say again, Wesley.
When you talk about the frequency of shift in the ionosphere, isn't it related to VLF and ULF and to XCM?
Okay, there's a lot of people talking about a lot of different things, I think. There is analogy, in the good old days, WA2CDL, he used to love Fox Hunts. He would get these little transmitters, 10 meter, 2 meter, and then the idea was to find where the transmitter is. And the guys with the biggest amount of money would have Doppler direction finders. I was always a little confused by that because I don't really understand why it's called a Doppler. My understanding of the underlying principle is that it's more registering phase differences based upon the distance between two known antennas with a particular given separation between the two of them. So my understanding, I could be totally wrong, is that it's more of a phase calculation, that you get these two signals, and you calculate the difference in the phase between the two received signals from the single transmission point, and based upon the distance between the two antennas, you approximate the direction of the transmission. And, it fine-tunes it depending upon how you change the direction of the Doppler devices. And usually there's more than two antennas. There's an array of antennas all hooked up to comparators. But I think they're comparing phases, although you could sort of say that a phase is related to frequency. So maybe that's why they're calling it a Doppler directional finder, but I don't think it's standard. It uses a Doppler effect as much as phase shifting.
There was also time delay of arrival. I don't know if that's phase shift as well, but that uses really quadrature or at least four antennas.
Yeah, time delay gives you a phase shift because the phases are no longer in line because one took longer to get to you.
Roger. Well, we're talking about, or at least I'm talking about, I don't know what Wesley's talking about. I'm talking about, a station in Kansas transmits all over the world and everyone receives the signal and they calculate the frequency based on however they calibrate. And then they send it into a server, and everyone gets scored based on how far they are off from the frequency that's transmitted. Anyway, it's probably beyond the scope, and we're after 10 o'clock, so I'll drop it for now. AC2, Bill.
Okay, I mean, the frequency detection, the ARRL regularly has that as an activity a couple times a year. Usually, guys use rather sophisticated equipment, and they use averaging. But I don't think it has anything particularly to do with Dopplers.
Yeah, Roger, but the frequency shifts. You actually watch it with time. Everyone uses one of these, these Spectrum Lab type software packages, and you receive the signal, and you watch it just wander back and forth across the calibrated frequency. I used a very simple system, and I got within, I don't know, 10 millihertz of the actual frequency. It was all calibrated, a GPS disciplined oscillator. But the point is that it wanders back and forth. It's not my oscillator or my receiver that was oscillating or going back and forth. It was the actual signal. And that's been observed over and over with a lot of calibrated receivers.
Yeah, I would assume that this is primarily an effect of the ionosphere acting as though it had fluidic motion. It's not a liquid. It's a gas, but its motion is fluidic. So it ebbs and flows, and so if there's movement in it, that's when there's going to be some Doppler shifting, I would think, superimposed on it. Not enormous amount, but enough for people who are trying to get it right in one part per million to notice the slight variation.
Absolutely. You got it exactly right there. I think it's got to be a little bit of wishy-washiness in the ionosphere. Otherwise, where else does it come from? But it's fascinating, and the techniques that people come up with to actually measure it accurately are also equally fascinating. Anyway, AT2PL back to that. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome, Jeff. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limewire Technical Net. We still have a little bit more time, so if anyone has anything they'd like to bring up right now, please hit that push to talk. Golly gosh, I guess I tired you guys out. Well, we'll ask one more time, and if not, then I guess we'll have an early SpaceNet report. We'll see. Anyone with any comments or questions or topics, short one, before the SpaceNet report, please, hit that push to talk. Okay, nothing much heard. I just want to put in my 2 cents worth. Jeff mentioned that my signal sounds reasonably good. My guesstimate of what might be going on is it's not coincidental that the people that hear me distorted, Rich, is listening on an Echolink feed, and John is listening on an All-Star link feed. So there might be some kind of strange little settings that I'm from the input that I'm going into the All-Star link to Echolink and All-Star outputs that are adding some distortion. It's possible. I'll talk to Lou over the week and ask him his opinion. So maybe that's what's going on. I record this anyway. I record it through the radio. So it's not my voice going directly to the recording. It's going to the radio and then being recorded. So I'll have a better idea of whether I sound distorted based on radio transmissions as opposed to Echolink, which I also record, and AllStar, which I don't because...